All right, welcome back, folks. This is the Bibliotakes podcast. Cody and myself are recording episode 4 of our Jurassic Park series today, season, however you want to call it. Last time we said that we were going to wrap the book today, I believe. Change of plans.
We may have said that. Who's to say?
Iteration 5 turned out to be quite the doozy and demanded an entire episode. And so we're doing that today. So get comfy. It's going to be a fun time.
More content for you. Congrats. More time in Jurassic Park with your favorite, you know, huge morons running the world's most ill-fated tourist attraction.
I kept forgetting how short a time period we're actually talking about here. And you're reminded of it frequently throughout. But it's like we arrived at the island yesterday. Mm-hmm. And now it's like early morning the day after you got there. And we're talking about increments of time that are like 30 minutes apart.
I was thinking about the time, too, because they do a good job of reminding you it. And, you know, one of the things that one of the goals of specifically Grant has been trying to get back to the either visitor center or the bungalow lodge so that they can use a phone to inform the shipping, the big like shipping barge that has the velociraptors on it, warn them not to land.
Right.
And so you're constantly reminded, oh, we only have 12 hours. Now we have 10 hours. Oh, we're going down to 5 hours. So like you can, there's a kind of like an actually cool, like action movie countdown built into the process. And speaking of movies, we'll talk about the movie. It's going to be a really fun movie pod that we love to do here. But usually when we're reading these books, a lot of time we're reading them after we've already seen the movie. And that's exactly what is the case with this one. You know, we've both seen Jurassic Park probably a dozen times combined. And usually you think to yourself, like, you're it's hard not to compare it to something like that. One thing, especially through the end of this book, the events are very different than the movie.
Cody, before you keep going, I know you said combined a dozen times. I think I've maybe seen this movie twice, and it's been long, long time. So I honestly don't even remember how it ends.
Still correct, by the way. I've seen this movie like 10 plus times. So
right.
so that's fine. Paul's math is still good. But it doesn't necessarily matter. Because even if you've seen the movie just one time, they're the kind of vibe and the aesthetics I find actually very helpful as framing objects for the events of the book, just because you can kind of picture in your mind, especially like, you know, T-Rex and velociraptors, they're relatively similar, kind of like big long-tailed, you know, predatory lizards that are going to eat you. But just kind of seeing the environment they're in, kind of like just like the space that they're operating. Oh, they got the electric land cruisers kind of in a ride formation. And because the events are so different, I'm able to see them, but with the kind of vision of the movie playing in my head. And I actually find that helpful as like a spacing mechanism, because like last week, especially, we cut back and forth and back and forth and into a third perspective. Oh, and this is a fourth perspective we haven't been in a while. And so just having that kind of mental visual space, like a sandbox to play in for all the events of the book, I find it very helpful.
This would not be the first book that has been a valuable tool for me, at least. You know, I think parts of Lord of the Rings was that way. You know, movies where scale and imagination are definitely part of it, at times it kind of helps to have some kind of reference point. Even if it maybe, and there are cons to that too, you know, because it maybe takes away from the amount that you can imagine.
Sure.
Something.
That's a fair counterpoint. Yeah.
But I'm with you about the benefits of it as well. You know, my reference point to something that's been going on in this book, we've been hearing about people get attacked by dinosaurs and, you know, ripped open by dinosaur claws and things. And my point of reference for that is standing in front of my fridge, getting out ingredients to make myself a very simple turkey sandwich and having both of my cats attack my ass at the same time. Literally both jump and cling on to my person.
Oh my God.
Claws dug into me. And all I'm thinking is, I'm getting attacked by two velociraptors right now.
Yeah, you got, because you got some compies in your house for sure.
Yeah,
I one thing also with this is, you know, I have a tendency, I'm sure others do as well, to kind of be like, to see action points and think to yourself like, oh, come on, like, you got to get up, you got to recover from that. When's the last time you stubbed your toe? You know, and it like crippled you.
Dude, here's another one. I fell down the stairs this weekend working on my house. And the amount of like embarrassment and rage in falling down the stairs as a grown man.
Did you like your heels slip and you're just like down it?
I can show.
Oh yeah, dude, your arm's so cut.
Just like fucking busted open, like busted up my arm, like
audio medium showing me your arm on the screen. But
I know,
but yeah, for the viewers at home, just imagine a big like 3-inch gash down Paul's forearm because he, you know, did a boo-boo down the stairs.
Yeah, so I'm not, you know, there's no part of me that isn't sympathizing with these people getting attacked by prehistoric murder machines.
Yeah,
you
know? Okay,
I'm here for it.
Speaking of getting attacked by prehistoric murder machines, let's hop into iteration 5. What do you say?
Yeah, let's do it. Real quick. Last time where we left off, we stopped after finishing iteration 4 in this book where Grant and the kids are floating down a river following a near escape from a T-Rex, and the nerds in the control room have gotten systems back online, but are struggling to find all the dinosaurs they need, as well as Grant and the kids.
Okay, so Muldoon and Gennaro, buddy cop, are, dude, you know...
Thank you! I had this note like later in the chapter. I was like, is Muldoon and Gennaro just like the most out-of-the-box buddy cop duo of all time?
They even have Hammond, their angry captain, yelling at them like, Muldoon, you're out of line. Gennaro, you got to keep them in track.
One more time and I'm taking your badge.
And Muldoon's like, I'm the only one that knows how these bastards operate. Okay, so Muldoon and Gennaro are observing the site where the T-Rex attacked hadrosaurs. Muldoon is drinking whatever constitutes room temperature in tropical Costa Rica whiskey and explains that the T-Rex could easily outrun their Jeep and just toss it. And that's why they're kind of hiding in the not in the open, kind of in the tree line. He asks Gennaro if he wants to live dangerously, to which Gennaro just says, sure, which is, again, that's buddy cop line.
Yes, no doubt.
Which, you know, if you, the last thing you want is a like drunk Australian game warden behind the wheel of a Jeep just going, you want to live dangerously? I'd be like, oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
sure is a great answer for that question. Mm-hmm. So they find the site of the dead hadrosaur, and then they get word that Nidri has been found. They found his body unsurprisingly mangled. The compies have been eating it, and Gennaro notices that the compies have these little like creepy five-fingered hands, and they kind of like rub their face with it. It makes them look like eerily human-like. But Muldoon has what he came for. He found the rockets in that Jeep, and they're just like, and Gennaro asks, are we going to do anything with Nidri's body? And he's like, what the fuck are we going to do with that body? Leave it for the compies. We got way bigger fish to fry. Like, fuck that guy. he can just get eaten by compies. Like, he's like, also, here's another cylinder I found. It's about like $1 million worth of embryos. Like, you're the lawyer. You have to have no sympathy for this guy. So we then cut to Grant in his raft. The end of the last section, he was sleeping as they drifted down the river. Lex is being petulant and cruel to Tim when all of a sudden they hear a blood-curdling scream. Flash cut to Muldoon. He's frustrated that Arnold can't find the T-Rex and the kids on the map or motion sensors. And Grant and the kids, meanwhile, have found a way to float their way into the aviary as a way to search for phones at this kind of secondary lodge. We then smash cut to the control room where Arnold and Malcolm are kind of talking. Malcolm explains that the detection problems that they've been having are because of all the uncovered areas like roads and rivers. They're all connected. So everyone says, like, oh, we can watch 92% of the park. okay, well, the other 8% actually form these like highways where an animal can hypothetically move completely undetected. And they just never thought of that.
The 8% isn't like dots around the park. It's like a contiguous, like you said, highway. Yeah. And Arnold, I'm just getting so fed up with some of these people. Like Arnold doesn't think the animals are smart enough to navigate using these highways as you put them, Cody. Wake the fuck up, man. What do you think is going on here?
This book is infuriating when you realize that the only guy who has his head on straight at this park is currently wasted in a Jeep with rocket launchers. That's the only guy who I would ever trust doing anything in this park. He's shit-faced right now, driving behind a motor vehicle, and he's the only one that knows how to like operate the bazookas that they have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's Muldoon blowing right now, he's Cody?
Like I have a note here too. He doesn't believe that he like says that the animals are stupid. They're not smart enough to do it. Malcolm's like, I don't know, man. They seem pretty smart to me. And Arnold explains that he hopes the kids aren't in the aviary because the pterodactyls they have are territorial and will dive bomb you. They just dive bomb all their workers in there. So that's why the aviary isn't done, because they can't do shit there. They accidentally moved in the pterodactyls in the middle of construction to acclimate them. But then the pterodactyls were like, cool, this is our place now. We're just going to attack every like construction worker trying to like, you know, spray insulation inside the lodge.
Oh my God. These poor guys. I know, sweet gig. They're paying overtime on the island for construction.
Dude, no. Okay, we have one story of Ed Regis flying like a guy to like kind of like a more remote Costa Rican hospital. You know, he was like once a week on the private helo going to San Jose. Like, hey, yeah, this guy fell. He's got like a pterodactyl spear mark through his chest. So the kids, they are at the aviary, by the way. That warning was very, you know, funnily timed. And so you're like, I bet they're going to get dive bombed. So they're at the lodge. Lodge isn't open. They never finished it. There's no phones in there. No fucking shot. They go back to the boat. And before that, they see ceradactyls. So not pterodactyls that have like pointed beak nose. These are ceradactyls. I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly. And they have more alligator-like tooth jaws. So you can't get speared by these, but they go down and attack them. And they're going after Lex, like biting her and trying to grab her and lift her into the air. Grant has to tackle this thing and get them to stop. So they actually end up taking her really nice baseball mitt. And she's like pissed about that. But like, again, Lex, priorities, honey. I know you're a little girl. I try to give her grace in this book. She is insanely. It is really hard to give Lex the benefit of the doubt.
For those, obviously, like it's been 2 weeks since we, you know, posted our last episode in this. Don't forget that Lex was also the one who just had a coughing fit like 20 feet away from a T-Rex that almost got them killed. So that's,
and then
that's,
when they told her to be quiet, started yelling at them for telling her what to do.
Right. And that type of behavior, I'm with you, Cody. Like, I want to just be like, oh, it's okay, she's just a kid. But at times, I'm like, I am losing patience with the liabilities on the island right now. Like, yes. The people who are offering very little or actively making things worse. And we can throw them into a column for you. Hammond, Lex. Who else do we got?
Nidri. We got
Nidri, Arnold, Regis. Luckily, Woo. A couple of these people are dead already. Woo, dude. Sure. But
Woo doesn't know what is on the island. He's just making fucking dinosaurs. And he's like, yeah, that one's got a weird duck bill. I'm sure some fucking nerd like Grant will name it. Who knows? Anyway, I'm so smart. Okay, we'll get to
Woo. Woo's in the lab making dinosaur soup with ingredients that aren't labeled.
No, oh yeah, he's just like a little bit of frog, and we got a little bit of hamster. Gonna tie in some fucking king cobra for the spitting venom. That's hot. We love it. Oh man, I got a fucking problem on my hands. How did this happen? Okay, 2.5 hours remain before the ship with the raptors docks in Costa Rica, fucking the planet permanently. So on the raft, Grant explains that a portion of frog DNA theory, he explains a portion of this theory to Tim as to how the animals could be performing sexual reproduction when they're supposed to be hypothetically sterile. Lex mentions that Tim is very interested in sex, and the as like a side comment to be annoying. And this line made me burst out laughing alone in my apartment.
Yeah.
The quote is, "They both ignore her." Just so good. Like Grant and Tim are just so over Lex. Like, okay, fine. Good one. But we don't get a full explanation. Suddenly, the T-Rex lunges at them through the foliage in the river. The T-Rex is pretty, like, fixated on them at this point. He's pretty mad that he can't eat this thing. He wants to very badly. And the T-Rex is unable to because the foliage is so dense leading to the river. He can't escape. It's almost caught him in a net. Just when they...
This line from Lex made me laugh. She just goes, "I hate him."
Yeah, she hates that guy.
This 8-ton dinosaur tries to eat them. I hate him.
Also very funny that, like, you know, I think it's a little bit of foreshadowing that they're so callous about the dinosaurs that they refer to what are female Tyrannosauruses as him, both of them as him. Because we just kind of end up doing that. We just kind of end up gendering the dinosaurs in ways that we find right. And then it turns out, oh, there's some weird kind of reproductive sex organ nonsense going on. I found that very funny.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of the more dominating carnivores on the island tend to be gendered or misgendered hims.
Mm-hmm.
While a lot of the, you know, herbivores or prey of these things, it's like, yeah, we're still good calling them hers or just its.
It just shows a real lack of, like, intention. Because if they actually really care, they'd be like, no, they're females. That's what they are. We know that. We're not just, like, assuming that. So,
well, I mean, the name of Tyrannosaurus Rex is gendered.
It's a gendered Latin name. Yeah. Rex is king, the tyrant lizard king. Right. And he is being a tyrant as he is going slightly upriver of them every time, but then just like lunging his jaws out like a terrifying universal ride. But all of a sudden, they get distracted by the T-Rex because they hear a lot of hooting, like owls in the forest. That's not good. We know what that is. Back at control, Malcolm explains to Ellie why he kind of has this derision for scientists and technicians with a condition he calls thin-telligence. Only the ability to see the immediate problem with no sight of consequences for performing a solution to that problem. So this is where we get they spent so much time thinking about how they could and not at all whether or not they should. We get that line. And he believes that all scientific, quote, discovery is more about achievement, getting there first, because if you don't discover this thing, someone's going to, they're going to take the credit, they're going to take the glory, and without caring how much damage you potentially leave in the wake. He specifically mentions that on the moon after the Apollo missions, there's trash and debris that we've left there. There's, you know, obvious problems with, you know, mining, things like that. The damage done to the Earth in the name of scientific discovery, he believes, is not worth any of the, quote, progresses that humanity has had in the last, you know, 500 years since organized science has really been a thing during the Enlightenment and Renaissance.
Yeah, he says discovery is always a rape of the natural world. And goes on to basically question Ellie about what a dig site that she works on looks like once they're done. And it's just kind of like, yeah, this is just kind of how this goes. Like, we just tear shit up. We make messes. We don't clean them up. All in the interest of this, you know, achievement, which in his mind hasn't really led to any significant advancement. Anyway, I thought the interesting thing that Malcolm said is he cites some kind of, you know, some sort of estimation about like a caveman, right, would basically work 8 hours a week or something for like food he needed.
He makes this very like, you see this argument online now.
Yeah.
Anecdotally, I do at least, that like, oh, Greg, we must return to when when all you had to do was like forage for nuts and berries and you hunted like one deer.
Yeah.
And that fed you for like 2 weeks. And it was like 20 hours of work. And then everyone else got to like, you know, do cave paintings and like, you know, make like leather drums. And, you know, he really does like to brush over the fact that, you know, penicillin's good. I like that. I like having air conditioning. It air conditioning prevents like a million deaths a year. What are you talking about?
Yeah, drink this entire thing of morphine and call me in the morning. Like, I'm pretty psyched that we've advanced past that. You know, I would consider that an advancement.
Yeah, his idea that, you know, these discoveries aren't advancing us any further is kind of, you know, he kind of shoots himself in the foot with this a little bit later. He is also, we should say, absolutely tripping balls on morphine right now. He's right. Shooting from the hip for the rest of the book. He is drugged to the gills.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny someone saying that these scientific advances haven't done anything as someone who is currently extending their life with a concoction of multiple scientific advancements. But, you know, but there is a little bit of irony there that I find funny.
Mm-hmm.
So Grant and the kids make it to the river and they see a pair of Dilophosaurus who were doing the hooting. They're doing a mating ritual across from each other in the river, kind of like one does like a hoot, goes down to drink water, raises its head. The other one matches it like a mirror, like goes down to drink water, comes up, does a pretty weird. Grant's like, oh, science guy. That's kind of interesting. They wonder what to do because they're going to see them and maybe they can swim. Maybe they can't. You don't really want to take that gamble. But suddenly they see them turn away from the banks and they get down and hide in the raft because they see the T-Rex is trying to break through and the Dilos are like hooting at it, you know, not necessarily taunting it, but they're kind of telling it to back off. But they're able to slip past the Dilos downstream. We cut back to Muldoon and Gennaro, buddy cop. Muldoon is shit-faced. He's absolutely hammered right now. And you know what? He's the only guy that was right. And if I was him, you know, you kind of have to assume, like, I'm currently dinosaur hunting right now. Good chance I'm going to die. Going to have a few swigs of whatever it is he's pulling right now. Probably makes
the two people who were actually saying that this park is not a great idea, Malcolm and Muldoon, and both just happen to be like sky high right now.
Sky high. Yeah. one's on morphine, one's drunk. And you know, Gennaro, as soon as he saw the dinosaurs, his skepticism was replaced by dollar signs exploding out of his head like a Looney Tunes. But now he's back on the this place needs to get nuked train, which you know, better late than never, Gennaro. But Muldoon's wasted. They get a ping about T-Rex, and Arnold tells them not to hurt him because it's a big tourist attraction. And Muldoon basically turns to Gennaro and does like the fart noise jerk-off motion. Like, yeah, I'm not going to hurt him. So Muldoon and Gennaro do find the T-Rex. And after a cool explanation of kind of how dinosaurs have like the variety of mammals, both in appearance and their temperament, we get a chance to see Muldoon try and shoot the T-Rex with basically a RPG sized syringe full of a massive tranquilizer. And he shoots once, misses. He says the laser sight is dead because it was probably left on all night because Nidri is a bastard. But I think it also has something to do with the fifth of whiskey he has been fisting the entire time they've been looking for T-Rex. But that's neither here nor there. So they shoot again. He doesn't think it's missed, but the T-Rex doesn't react at all because it's an 8-ton T-Rex. And they barely escape with their life when they head back to the visitor center for more ammunition.
So we cut back to Grant and the kids, who it's like you had to know this was coming. They're floating down a jungle stream and they finally reach the like necessary waterfall that's in any story like this involving any kind of river or stream.
They're on a mountainous island.
No,
you think they just have flat streams all over the mountain island?
Well, okay. We can talk about how legit this is in a moment.
Yeah.
But okay, so we're heading for a waterfall here. And Lex unfortunately lets us know that she can't swim and that her life jacket isn't clasped.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Just so you know what's great about Grant?
Yeah.
He was like, you know what? Not my problem right now. I got to stop this thing. He was like, I don't even have time to process that information. Thank you for telling, but I do. Then, okay.
Right. So as if falling off of a waterfall isn't bad enough, at the bottom of the waterfall, 50 feet down, the T-Rex is just waiting for them, basically like mouth open, like, come on down. So,
yeah, but they're not smart, Arnold. You moron.
Right. Okay. So the three of them end up going over the waterfall and Grant hits the water, rushes past the foot of the T-Rex, manages to get on shore downstream and pulls Tim up shore as he comes along. He sees in a moment the T-Rex with Lex's life vest in his mouth, but luckily sees Lex's body floating downstream. So he dives in, he goes, rescues her, resuscitates her. And then the three of them see this path with a boot print in it from somebody else. And they're like, okay, that looks promising. So they follow that up, leads them back up towards the waterfall and behind where the water is falling to this area that has a bunch of like equipment and basically like big like water pumps. So clearly there's something man-made about this waterfall and perhaps the stream and how it works. Anyway.
But they can't get cameras there, by the way.
Right. Of course. So in this equipment room, there also happens to be a door with a keypad. And Grant's like, let's hope that behind this door, I can get to a phone. So he opens the door with the code that's just like etched on the key box, gets in. It's dark inside and the kids don't want to go in. And Grant's like, look, I don't have time for this. So you stay here. I'm going to go. I'll be right back. Grant goes in, door closes and locks behind him. He manages to find a flashlight, go down some stairs and finds this electric like golf cart just sitting there at the beginning of this thin, long tunnel. Out of nowhere, this juvenile velociraptor jumps at him. And at the last minute, Grant is able to shoot him with his trank gun. And because this velociraptor is like a very small one, the dosage on this trank is like way too much for this thing. And is like, this thing is like near death. But Grant notices that this is a male raptor, which means bred in the wild. So again, these dinosaurs are breeding. Things are happening more naturally now in the park. Grant goes back to the door and has to wait for the kids to open the door. But Lex and Tim are waiting for Grant to open the door on the other side when they see the T-Rex throw its head through the waterfall at them. So the end of his snout is coming through the water. The T-Rex can't see past the waterfall coming down. And so what it resorts to is just sticking its tongue out and feeling around for Lex and Tim behind the waterfall. I don't know how you felt about this, Cody, but this tongue is described as stinking of urine and being like muscular all the way through, like an elephant trunk.
Yeah, and it's a forked tongue too, so it's almost like it can like grab.
Yeah, and that's exactly what it does, is it finds it with its tongue, finds Tim, kind of like grabs him and starts pulling him towards its mouth. And Tim's like kind of resigned to death until at the very last moment, the T-Rex bites down on its own tongue, releasing Tim, and the head falls out of the waterfall. So here we cut back to control and they see that the T-Rex is down. Hooray. Turns out that Muldoon did hit it with his trank gun. It just took an hour for the anesthetic to take effect.
Muldoon vindicated.
Yeah. So the T-Rex is out cold in the water and they have to go put it back in its cage. Arnold is taking this victory lap when they realize something incredibly upsetting. The park has been running on auxiliary power ever since they reset the system. And that auxiliary power just shut off. Now, we're going to get back to that. But first, we have to cut to Tim, who looks at the T-Rex and sees that this T-Rex just has a canister in its head and kind of feels sorry for it. And it's at this point that the waterfall comes to a stop and the door opens for Grant. So again, auxiliary power just cut out, which means that the pumps aren't working to operate the waterfall. Locks aren't working on doors right now. We cut back to control where they realize what the problem is. Since they got the power back on and they've been running on this auxiliary power, they've been relying on a power source that's really only intended to jumpstart the generator. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have enough juice basically to power the park for an extended period of time. So in addition to that, it doesn't have enough power at all to power electric fences. So we realize that the electric fences have just been down for like 5 hours.
So this is another example of Malcolm being the big right, because his whole thing is like, you can design it as intentionally as you can. You can't control outside factors. And when they rebooted the system thought that they suffered some type of catastrophic emergency, which is why it defaulted to auxiliary power. That's what it's supposed to do. But they realized that they just didn't check if they were running on main or auxiliary. And yeah, Muldoon just hears, wait, fences down for 5 hours?
Yeah, let's go back really quick, Cody. One thing that I thought was interesting was Tim almost feeling sorry for the T-Rex being incapacitated.
I have a note on that too.
Pairing that, or, you know, comparing that to Gennaro's reaction to leaving Nidri behind, his body behind. We have like an interesting mix of characters here where our sympathies for different dead or incapacitated or harmed things varies.
Yeah, it's interesting because like Muldoon is so desensitized to the park. He's like, fuck it. Fuck everything. I'll kill any of these animals. If you die, you die. Like, he's almost got this animal-like instinct, having spent so much time in this park. Just ruthlessness. And I didn't actually pick up on the Gennaro one, but it makes sense. I compared it to Grant in my note, where Tim really seems like to have a sympathy for the dinosaurs the way that Grant does. Like, this velociraptor attacked him. Probably would have killed him if it had been given the chance. But Grant sees how young it is, how quickly and aggressively the tranquilizer is harming it, and then moves to try and save its life. And then even offer it comfort, like stroking its head, trying to pet it. Just very interesting.
Yeah. I wonder what it, I might just need to like noodle on that a little bit more. That could be something, I don't know. Crichton's been just making all of these like really in your face, on the nose claims through Malcolm, it seems, about how he feels about science at large and business, you know,
and the business of scientific discovery. It seems like he really likes to synthesize those.
Yeah. Yeah. The stuff that is a little less, it's a little more between the lines, it seems like, are some of these moments where it's just a sentence here and there about a character looking at something that is dead, dying, hurt, something, and feeling shame, sympathy, empathy, you know, something like that. And I think that might be something to ask our guests when they come on next time. So
yeah, have some theories, but we can save them. So cut back where Muldoon has realized that the park has been without the main source of security from the animals, which is the electrified fencing system. They hear a scream, and Muldoon places Jurassic Park under what I call Muldoon law. It is a version of martial law where Muldoon is in charge now. This is like in our ancient episodes on Return of the King, where Gandalf, the siege of Minas Tirith has been broken. Aragorn has not yet ascended the throne, and everyone just decides that it is now time for Gandalf to be in charge. He was just, you know, a 3,000-year-old adult who was obviously supposed to be the kind of interim boss for this time. And that's what Muldoon is. Muldoon is commandeering the park. He's barking orders.
For battle.
Yeah, exactly. Hammond, flee for your lives. Abandon your posts. If it was up to Hammond, he would emulate himself, you know, with a stegosaurus, just so sad. he's barking orders. Muldoon and Gennaro go get the launchers. And he's like, yeah, these launchers are going to be necessary. Dinosaurs are really hard to kill. And he goes to like Hammond. He's like, Hammond, go to the lodge. Don't argue with me. Get the fuck in the lodge. Not hearing about it. You can like you yell at me later. And, you know, they go outside and he's like, Arnold, go to the mech shed. You need to jumpstart the system. Like, we need these defenses on now. But after they go and get the rocket launchers, they go to and see Arnold at the mech shed. And they see that three raptors have cornered Arnold before he's even gotten to the shed yet. And they're doing like the fanning thing where one is directly in the center of the tune, slowly fan out, pack hunt. And reminder, the only weapons, for some reason, at Jurassic Park are these tranks. You either get the shitty hand tranks that are good for shooting like compies and nothing else. And then you have the like M1 Law ones, which are the RPG tranks, which are like good for like putting a T-Rex asleep in like an hour. And there doesn't seem to be a good middle ground. You know, it doesn't seem to be a good middle ground. But that doesn't matter to Muldoon, who is probably blowing like a 0.28 at this point. He fires his rocket launcher at the velociraptors and straight up liquefies one of these things. Like the time for mercy with these animals has gone out the door. It is now that we are in cull mode. We are culling these fuckers. And so he also gives like a straight up, again, 80s buddy cop action movie line. So he has sawed this thing in half with a rocket launcher. Half of it goes into a tree. The other half like this twitching on the ground. And he just goes, that'll wake you up.
I'm waiting for the line that's describing him with like a cigar hanging out of side of his mouth.
Oh yeah.
You know, like how is that not part of this guy's character?
Exactly. He's like, yeah, that's like a pit of velociraptors. And he like has a cigar and he's like filling the pit with gasoline. And he flicks the cigar butt in.
Right. Yeah,
exactly. This guy Muldoon's built different. We love Muldoon. I do. And at one point, the two of them are cornering them. And he tells Gennaro to reload because now he has they have the full attention of the other two raptors. And he's so badass because he's like, oh, this could be pretty bad, Muldoon. And Muldoon just says, load. He's like, he's just over everyone. And I just love that scene. I thought it was so funny.
Oh,
I thought it was so funny.
It's so great.
It's like, you know, these dinosaurs have been running a roughshod on our team for a long time. So it feels good to have a little bit of payback. Wu is in the control room. He's been assigned to the control room because he's the only one who kind of vaguely knows the controls since Arnold is trying to boot things up in the mech room. Muldoon, it does go badly, by the way, for him and Gennaro. And he falls down an embankment and the raptors seem to ignore Gennaro and try to chase him. Hammond is in the lodge. Malcolm goes off on Hammond for having, you know, the quote, simple idea of Jurassic Park. Malcolm compares like this scientific get rich quick scheme to inherited wealth. There's no effort or discipline involved in like inheriting a ton of money. And so therefore there's no discipline that comes with having the power that comes with that sort of money. He kind of labels it to like a guy who studies for years to become a black belt knows discipline and when to use violence. But someone who like, you know, picks up a gun at a store has so much inherent power that they're not necessarily qualified or disciplined to handle.
Yeah. Yeah. So, there is a discipline built in to the learning of a practice. Mm-hmm. There's a certain respect for the tool that you're using, like a martial artist through learning karate, becoming a master. Part of that discipline is learning when not to use lethal force. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, Hammond's like, but you don't understand. It was so simple. Dinosaur theme park. And Malcolm asks the great follow-up question. If it's so simple, then why did it all go wrong? You know,
pretty easy question. Look, Cody, you said a couple episodes ago that, you know, Malcolm was, you know, pissing you off a little bit with this stuff. And I'm with you at this point. It's like, dude, we get it. Like I was all for the smug I told you so initially. And now it's like, why? I understand what you're saying. Now is not the time.
Hammond's like, shut up, Malcolm. This is still a sick idea. As people are being killed by raptors, like 100 feet from him.
Yes. But Malcolm is also all at once, he's like high on morphine, you know, dying from like a lethal injury on his leg, and somehow able to like offer up these pages long like speeches.
Yeah.
About his the diatribe. State of the scientific community. And it's just kind of like, who are you? Like, why? Maybe focus on you not dying.
Okay, let's so start it's so funny because this is so funny because this actually pisses me off less than it did earlier, because he's actually explaining his work. Earlier in the book, he was like, ah, yes, just as I thought. And then everyone's like, what do you mean? He's like, don't worry about it. That made me mad. At least now he's like, you know, talking through his process, explaining what he's thinking. But yes, there are times when I'm reading these and I'm like, and then Malcolm gives a long diatribe about the state of, you know, the business of science and the irresponsibility of it. Shouts to Crichton, you know, he's a great writer, clearly has a lot of opinions. Malcolm, we get it. You told us so. You super did. Anyway, there's guys.
And I agree with what you're saying. It's just like every three pages, do I need to come back and hear another reason you're right?
Yeah.
At this point, like I get it. I just don't. It feels clunky the way it's like inserted into the story.
Yeah, it does, especially because we're cutting back and forth from like, you know, Muldoon being Schwarzenegger in Predator.
Yeah.
Okay, so Arnold gets to the maintenance room and it's completely black because there's no power, so there's no light. So to get some light, he props the door to the room open with his shoe because Arnold is the dumbest man alive. And so he goes down the catwalk, and as he does that, he sees a velociraptor sniffing his shoe and going to investigate this open door. Who could have seen that? So Wu is kind of going over procedure in his head in the control room when he gets a call from Muldoon. Muldoon is straight up dieharded in a drain pipe surrounded by velociraptors. So one of the velociraptors... So it's like obviously too big for the velociraptors to get it, and he's pretty wedged in there, just him. And when one of the velociraptors tried to peek up to take a look inside, he just, again, annihilated it with the rocket launcher. And so the other, so he says that earned him a little bit of respect from the other velociraptor. That then, because they're so smart, like, okay, lesson learned. Don't stick your head in the pipe, or that man will straight up dissolve you with something that we don't understand, but all we know is that, you know, Gary over here now doesn't have like a side of his face. But it's very funny too, because Muldoon's so funny, dude. He's like, they've given me a little bit of respect, but I'm afraid I'm a pretty popular guy down here. Like, they're just still like kind of growling at him just out of sight. Dude, the velociraptors suck.
I swear to God, Muldoon has just been ready to die for like 40 years if this is his attitude for this shit.
Well, you got to remember, he was like not growing up, but he cut his teeth in like the African bush, surviving like lion attacks and cheetahs. And he knows about behaviors of tigers and rhinos and hippos. And he's also been day one, like, we need to kill the velociraptors. We cannot. He hates these things. And so he's finally a chance to fuck up T-Rex and velociraptors, the two biggest assholes on planet Earth. So Arnold is making his way to the stairs because he's pretty sure velociraptors can't do stairs.
Mm.
Uh-huh. Yeah. They can activate door handles.
Right.
And communicate non-verbally, but stairs. That's like, you know, a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the velociraptor gets around the stairs by just jumping down. He just, you know, bypasses the stairs entirely. Arnold immediately gets got. He's gone forever. Bye-bye. Too bad. Gennaro is running through the jungle after being separated from Muldoon, trying to get to the maintenance shed. Don't do that. That's not good in there. He gets there and he gets to the lower level and he's kind of walking around. And all of a sudden, above him, he sees a velociraptor on the pipes. When it attacks, he's actually apparently pretty strong and is able to push off this velociraptor. And he's trying to search for a weapon when all of a sudden it vanishes. These velociraptors can also kind of do the action movie trope of like, if you keep take your eyes off them for 1 second and look back, they're gone.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't really figure out Gennaro at this point in the book, which is okay. I mean, okay. You know, it's just like, what is this dude? Like, are you going to be, are you going to be brave about shit? Or are you going to be scared? Are you like, I don't understand his motivation all of a sudden for helping. Jacked. Yeah. I don't get him. I don't understand him at all.
Very weird. Very weird character. But suddenly his hand gets bitten and it kind of launches him off his feet. At this point, I think he's dead. We shall see. Everyone coordinates a plan to get people back to the lodge to kind of just make it a home base. Malcolm, you know, goes on another morphine induced rant about science replacing feudalism as a way to see the world during the Renaissance. But then it just kind of came the new system. And, you know, the world is now presenting science with questions that it cannot answer. He predicts a kind of great change that will happen. When Hammond tries to, like, kind of hand wave this, Malcolm says what I think everyone's thinking. He's like, hey, man, do you even think we're going to get out of here alive? To which the iteration ends.
Yeah, this part, I mean, so everything that I said about Malcolm annoying me, I can think and also think that the things he's saying are interesting.
Yes, correct.
I'm going to allow myself to double dip a little bit here. Yes, in a vacuum, the things Malcolm is saying are interesting, and I think they feel shoehorned into this story in kind of clunky ways.
I think your issue with it is the placement of them, you know, kind of tit for tat with the action. Like, it feels very weird. If all of that was just kind of this wandering diatribe of a morphined up guy for like the last 10 pages of this chapter,
yeah,
that would make more sense to us.
Yeah,
because it's kind of cutting back and forth almost like a movie, to be honest with you. But it's totally. Very jarring to read.
Well, and I think part of my other issue with this is that it seems like Crichton has chosen to just hyper localize his own voice in this one character.
Right.
In like a really obvious way.
Yeah, I feel like it would be almost easier to digest if Grant or even Gennaro was kind of saying some of these things.
Why is it that Malcolm is the only person that has this thought about this kind of stuff?
Okay, I just thought of this, maybe because, like, you know, it can't be Grant, because Grant is a scientist as well. And like, he would be kind of lured, if everything wasn't going crazy, he would probably be lured into the idea of Jurassic Park the same way a lot of other people were as well. You know,
that's the chance true. To
research dinosaurs and stuff. And since, you know, Malcolm is the one guy that was like, this is a bad idea because of chaos theory that none of you people understand, that's kind of the format he's chosen. But I think you're right. I think it would maybe be not more palatable, because again, we do find his statements interesting. It feel like it might be a bit more dynamic in the dialogue if another person was a skeptic and introduced that way, and then kind of having this is more than one person, I guess, be the source of this criticism.
Yeah, in the interest of time and respect to what I feel is like a super awesome book, I'm not going to try and, you know, tell Crichton to, you know, the late Crichton, rewrite this awesome work.
Right.
You know, like, fix it for me. No.
For me,
just throwing out some nitpicks. So this part, though, with Malcolm, his basically continuation from this could versus should idea in science, super interesting to me. About, you know, science has allowed billions of people to live together in the world, but it can't tell us what to do with the world that we live on. Mm-hmm. Super interesting. And he asserts basically that the great intellectual justification of science has vanished. In recent years, basically, we have discovered that there are limits to what we can understand through science. And then he cites things like Heisenberg's subatomic uncertainty principle, Gödel's theorem setting limits to mathematics, and his own chaos theory, basically. Super interesting. I'd need to look into all of that to check his sources on some of this stuff. But it's an interesting idea.
He does like a really big kind of storyboard idea where he's like this kind of great idea of history, which is like, you know, convenient because it doesn't actually require proof. It's just kind of like a, you know, during the Renaissance, there was this break from feudalism. There was still a lot of monarchical rule throughout the world. But it was then like, you know, there was the English Revolution, which introduced the idea of like a monarchy and a parliament, and the American Revolution, the French Revolution. So there's like this political change that happened because reason and science became so popular as kind of his ideas. Like, you know, science and enlightenment changed the way that politics and capital were kind of, you know, dispersed throughout society. And then now that we're in a quote unquote modern age, where hypothetically science and law and business are kind of ruling and not superstition and, you know, suppression of education. But all that does is like, there's no longer like the kind of moral anchor that right. science is supposed to be having where it's, oh, it's all about discovery. It's all about truth. It's all about that. It's like, oh, well, you know, it is about making money and it is about controlling things. And that is not necessary. And science can actually be so powerful in advancing those things. But that's, you know, that's just science. That's not capital S science. Does that make sense?
Totally. I feel you there. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
But I thought it was, yeah, really interesting way to end the iteration.
Yeah. Okay. So that is where we end our episode today. Next time we'll wrap up with iterations 6 and 7. A little bit longer page counts for those, but in terms of like total content, I think a little bit more manageable for an episode. So we'll see you guys on that next time. Before we go today, Cody, let's get into our most favorite and least favorite things about this section of reading, or our auto poops and life finds a way of the week. What do you have for your auto poop?
My auto poop this week was Lex. I couldn't do it. Couldn't do it. She's a liability. She's Ryan Gosling in Remember the Titans. She's just a fucking liability out there. You got to take her out.
Oh my gosh. What a great comp, dude. Ryan Gosling in that movie is the... And his dad, too?
Yeah, his dad's crazy, and it sucks because he's a great kid. You know, everyone in the locker room loves him, and even he knows. The only great difference is that he actually knows he can't keep up out there, coach. You got to take him out.
Yeah.
And he can't. He's just fucking on an island at corner, you know, knees are shaking. Get him out of there. He's not cut it. Light's too bright. And you know what, Lex? Shut the fuck up. Just like for me one time.
Yeah.
Like, how about one, a little gratitude to Grant for saving you. Two, quit hassling your brother. He likes dinosaurs. Sometimes he can think it's cool that he's in the dinosaur park. Whatever. Yeah. That's my auto poop of the week. Couldn't do it.
No, I'm with you.
I tried so hard. Like you said earlier, I tried so hard to give her the benefit of my... Just a kid, she's just a kid, she's just a kid. Crichton, you know, God rest your soul, you're a genius for writing the most annoying little kid character we've seen in a long time. Probably since Narnia, if I'm being honest with you.
Fair. Yeah.
When's the last time you got this frustrated with a child's behavior?
Well, you know, you're right. Like, I don't want to be too hard on her, but let's also remember what age she is. She's like 7, 8, right?
She's 8, yeah.
She isn't a 4-year-old.
Right.
And like, okay, maybe this is a little bit too harsh, but I'm going into this a little bit more because you all already know that my auto poop of the week is just the cutting back to Malcolm, like every few pages and going into his thesis again. Okay, but for yours, Cody, I don't think that being 8 years old automatically gives you a pass for not understanding the gravity of the situation that you're in.
That's third grade, right? Like,
I think it's like, I think kindergarten is like 7.
Kindergarten's like 5.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Whatever it is. So I was young.
They're deep into elementary school.
Sure. So all I'm saying is this. At one point in this story, we find Lex banging her head up against a drainage pipe, scared out of her shorts, where did that kid go? All we can use, like, we could use a little bit more of just scared Lex. Like, have a little bit more respect for the dire situation that you're in. Like, you clearly were capable of yesterday.
Yeah, right? She has, like, no object permanence where it's like, right. Okay, dinosaur's gone, danger gone. Time to right. be annoying again. Because then, like, a dinosaur would show up and she's like, I'm a scared, save me, Grant. And then it's just like, anyway, my brother's a dummy.
Yeah.
Isaac, shut up. Enough.
Yeah. So she's annoying. I also, and I mentioned this before, but I just don't get the Gennaro character. Don't understand what his deal is.
That's like, fair. It's hard to tell. It's hard to tell his deal.
Yeah. Okay. Your life finds a way of the week, dude.
Muldoon. My fucking guy. Every time the little paragraph started with Muldoon did this, I'm like, oh yeah, we're so fucking back. That's what I'm talking about, baby. Give me the fucking Muldoon spinoff. Give me the Muldoon cut of Jurassic Park where it's just Muldoon scenes. It's only like 40 pages long, but it's, you know, so sick.
I was going to say, as we were talking through the end of this last section, one thing I feel like we were totally robbed of is just Muldoon's charge from the drainage pipe back to the lodge for the regroup.
We were, because I think what happened was Wu got in with the Jeep and somehow scared away the raptors so that he could get in the Jeep. And that's where they got to the lodge, right? Because that's like the kind of format they play on the radio. Do that. But I need to see Wu, like, you know, in third gear in the Jeep, like hit a raptor, like super hard, like T-bone it. Then Muldoon hops in, like waving like one of the electric prods they have, you know, trying to keep it back. And then Wu just
throws Wu out of the driver's seat into the back seat of the car and just takes over at the wheel.
I need Muldoon to hit a velociraptor with Ed Regis's leg. Like, like a wingtip dress shoe with a wood sole just clocks a velociraptor on the eyebrow at mock speed. And that buys Muldoon like 5 seconds to hop in the Jeep and run away.
The idea that he's still carrying this leg around.
Oh, it's just God. In the tarp. It's just wrapped in tarp, waiting for the right moment. Smells like shit, but he just, you know, whap.
He would have had to be carrying it for like the last 12 hours.
It's so definitely great. Like, it's definitely like in the fridge in the employee break room. Yeah. I don't know where else it would be.
It's just labeled Muldoon. Do not touch.
Do not. It's like an Arrested Development, like Ed Regis leg. Do not eat. And someone opens it and just like, I don't know what I expect.
Okay, my life.
Muldoon is my guy. I want a tattoo of Muldoon's face on my chest. He's so sick.
Yeah, my life finds a way this week is it's just Grant. And I don't think I've talked enough to this point. So this is bleeding into previous sections a little bit, but like the dude is just a survivor.
Oh yeah.
And being able to do all of this while keeping those kids alive, like he truck sticked that pterodactyl.
Oh yeah.
And like there's a moment where it's like wrapped up in his wings and just beating the shit out of him. Like he's like trapped in a tent and a grizzly bear is just mauling him basically. Like that's what it's like in a pterodactyl's wings. And the dude just survives and gets the kids out with him. So huge props to Grant. He's my,
Grant. It's like Muldoon is obviously like action hero strong. He's probably like, you know, muscular, but a little leaner, you know, probably wearing like a khaki outfit. And Grant is just out here dad strong.
Oh, yeah.
I know he hasn't had to find abs since he was high school, but when push comes to shove, he's probably repping two plates. Hasn't lifted a weight in years. But could just throw it up if he needs to. That's just what I imagine.
No, he's the kind of guy where you're like, you're trying to gauge how strong he is. And you ask how much he benches. And he's like, I haven't benched in 20 years.
Yeah.
But then you look at his hands and somehow they're like thick. Like, what muscle are you working out in your fingers?
It's like he has no muscle definition anywhere on his body except his forearms.
Yeah, right.
And you're like, oh, like your hands are just C clamps, dude.
Yeah.
It's like a vice.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And for whatever reason, he has that weird dad thing too, where it's like he has unreal calves. Like, oh,
you it's don't like, even get me started on
like just right north of the dorkiest, like New Balance white socks combo you've ever seen. And just south of khaki cargo shorts are just like Premier League midfielder calves for no reason.
Yeah, the dude's got the calves of like a decathlete right beneath the longest like 11 inch inseam golf shorts you've ever seen.
Yeah, no, yeah, exactly. So Grant, shout out to you.
You know what, given the time period and like where he is, I promise you he hasn't worn shorts with an inseam longer than four. ever. No shot. Wears pants because he needs to in the desert because he's on his knees a lot, but when on his off day he's rocking like, you know, 1988 Nike jogging shorts.
I'm imagining Grant wearing those like zip away pants, but they zip away like way too high.
Yeah, the convertible pants reveal a 3-inch inseam. Like the his pocket space is hindered by how high the breakaway is.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my god.
He's got that, and then like still a Hawaiian shirt tucked in and a gut. Still has the beer gut. Because again, this guy's drinking beer all the time.
Every time
I find an egg in Montana, I just crush a Grain Belt premium. Or a PBR.
Oh, man. So much respect for Dr. Alan Grant. Yeah. Okay. Next time, we're going to finish up this book. Promise this time. Sorry for the confusion last episode. Hit us up on Instagram, Bibliotakes. Emails, bibliotakes@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see y'all next time.
We'll see y'all soon.